All right. Hey, everyone. It is the 25th of June for you, the 26th for me, because I am in the future. So fun to be with you for our second Module 6 group call. And yeah, we're going to build on what we were talking about last week. So I'll just share my slides here. Everyone can see those okay? Great. So we'll just revisit the aims of this module, and we're going to talk today about this is quite a interactive and practical session. We're going to really talk about how to coach around the protector, how to actually kind of use this insight into expanding the idea that our self-doubt is more than just a self-sabotaging inner critic. And then how to kind of draw that out of your client and how to work with it. So I'm hoping that you are energized and up for a bit of a coaching type session. And we'll give you some ideas for taking this stuff further with your practice pods. And just a reminder that there is a study group this week because it's the second module, second session of the module. So this time on Thursday, Scott will be available for your questions, explorations, deepened practice, whatever you need. Yeah. Okay, so what we're talking about when we talk about the protector is our clients' protective beliefs, their behaviors, and how these form patterns. So we can start out with a belief, I don't finish things, I'm unlovable. They're usually unhelpful beliefs, things that tend to hold us back and keep us safe. And we respond to those beliefs in, kind of matching behaviors, right? So if we feel like we're unlovable, then we'll behave in a way that helps protect us from that belief. Yeah, and over time, these beliefs and behaviors will form patterns. And what can happen is our clients start to believe that their patterns, their protective patterns, are actually features of their personalities, right? And we do this too, right? We do this too. And what our work is all about as self-belief coaches is helping our clients to interrupt these beliefs, these behaviors, these patterns, so that they can see what else is possible. Not only what else might be true, but what else is possible for them. How can they respond in different ways? How can they experiment with trying something new? And in our work, we help create a sort of safe home base for them to both plan those experiments and plan those new ways of being, and then report back and see how they're going so that they can have that support. Yeah. So the protector's job is really important. It's to keep us safe from perceived risks. These risks are almost always about experiences we've had in the past, and our protector is trying to help us to not repeat those. It recognizes, oh, you grew up in a home where you didn't have that sense of being loved. So if you believe you're unlovable, you won't have to repeat that sense of constantly being disappointing, right? You'll be able to kind of keep yourself safe from being hurt by that again. So those protectors feel safe when we hold ourselves back, right? Our protector is like, oh, great, I've done my job. You're holding yourself back. You're not putting yourself in the path of risk. This is success. This is great. That's what I'm here for, right? But for us and for our clients, we'll reach this point of tension where safety feels confining, right? It's no longer satisfying to be held back. And we can, access that in different ways. Usually, there's a sense of frustration. Our clients will say things like, oh, I just keep getting in my own way, or I keep sabotaging myself. Why can't I do this? Right. And so our job is to help them to make sense of that so that they can move towards more meaningful, fulfilling ways of being. So last week we talked about the four faces of the protector: the critic, the martyr, the scapegoat, and the bystander, and kind of how these how these parts of our psyche can show up, how they sort of interrupt our dreams and goals, how they are sort of shadows of our wider compass, our inner compass. So the critic is a shadow of self-belief, the martyr of self-acceptance, the scapegoat of self-worth, and the bystander of self-trust, right? And so what we want to do this week is really kind of look at how can we kind of shrink these protectors and expand the healthy adult self, right? How can we actually coach with our clients so that we can do that? What we've been doing over the last couple of modules in 4 and 5 is really expanding our clients' awareness of where these protectors have come from, kind of how they have kept us safe, why they're here. And in this module, what we're talking about is then how to shift it, how to really make that change. And in the coming modules, we're really moving into kind of looking at more of the healthy adult self and how we can expand that for our clients. It's quite on purpose that we do it in this order, because what I found is that for clients with self-doubt, a lot of self-doubt, if we jump straight to, right, let's build up your self-belief, but we haven't addressed the protective beliefs and behaviors and patterns that are present for them, it can actually expand the gap. It almost reconfirms why it's not safe for them to develop self-belief, right? So the program is structured in a way that follows the usual kind of coaching relationship. We make sense of where we are first, and then we start to develop different ways of being. Okay, so the thing to take away from this module is that we can't change the protector with the same energy that created it. Right? So you can't over perfect your way out of a critic protector. You can't quit enough for your scapegoat to feel safe. You can't wait long enough. There's no amount of time that you can wait for your self-trust to somehow magically pop up, right? So it's a really good thing to remember. And it's a great way to share this with clients, right? That actually you know, we can't go head on with a protector. We've got to come in from the side. We've got to create some new energy to kind of dismantle that structure. So this is how we do that. And I just want to share with you the coaching model. So remember, we've got self-belief with the shadow protector of the critic, self-acceptance with the martyr, self-worth with the scapegoat, and self-trust with the bystander, right? And so the way we coach is to go around the compass. So the critic is healed by self-acceptance. The martyr is healed by self-worth, the scapegoat by self-trust, and the bystander by self-belief. Right? So it's like, when I saw this pattern, and actually it was Scott who pointed this out to me, I was like, I kind of was intuitively feeling into this. And then it's like, oh, this makes so much sense. And so even in the early days of this program, when I was saying, well, you know, if we're going to heal a critic, we can't give you more jobs to do and more, you know, more things to prove yourself with. So the model is in the workbook, Holly, and it's right here in front of you as well. So don't panic if you don't have it right beside you. But just notice what we're talking about here. But it is in the workbook. I can't remember what page it's on. I don't have it beside me. Someone might have it with them, and they might be able to share this in the chat. But this is the way we coach, right? Around these these protectors. So I want to take you through what this looks like in detail, and then we're going to do some sort of like a demo, and you'll get some time with some breakout groups as well to play with this stuff. Yeah. So remember, the critic is, the perfectionist, right? That's the protective aim. Thanks. Yeah, it's in a couple of places. Holly, oops, page 17, page 185. Okay, cool. So the critic is all about being perfect, right? That's its aim. It's like, that's where safety is if I'm perfect. And it's all about these behavior, the beliefs I'm not good enough, and the behaviors I'm overworking all the time, overdoing, right? To manage this fear, I can't lose control, I can't be criticized by others, and I can't feel too much. Right? That's where the critic is. And so the thing to know about the critic is you can't do enough. You can't prove yourself enough. You can't work hard enough or be perfect enough for the critic to feel safe. That's not actually where safety comes from. All right. Instead, we've got to go into self-acceptance, which is all about compassion, imperfection, being with what is, right? Being with who you are in this moment, paying attention to your needs and your emotions. Right. And so when we're coaching with our clients, we're giving them some ideas to play with. How do you want to experiment with compassion and imperfection? And notice, like, even if you have quite a strong critic or a loud critic, you might find the idea of playing with imperfection and self-compassion something that you want to resist, right? But this is the thing to take away. If we're transforming our relationship with the protector, we need to transform that. We can't go into battle with it, right? We need to form a healthier response to it. And that means coming at this from a different energy than what created So, some ideas for how to experiment with compassion and imperfection is, and I'm just going to give you these ideas, and then we're going to come into like, how do we get this to kind of be real for our clients? Right, is to really play with like, where is the client overworking and what is that protecting them from? All right, so just and a great experiment to start with is always kind of auditing, where is this protector showing up? Where are you overworking? Where are you overdoing? What do you think that's protecting you from? Right, giving a client the experiment to practice speaking to themselves with compassion 100% of the time for a 24-hour period, a 48-hour, 72-hour period, a week, maybe, if someone's really gung-ho, is a fascinating experiment, right? Because all they're doing is challenging that critical, judgmental voice. And for someone who has a really loud critical voice, that can be an incredibly revealing and quite healing experience. And the way I will offer this to a client is, well, let's try something different. Right? You've got this really loud, quite judgy inner voice, and it may be that they've decided that it sounds like someone that's in their lives. It could be a parent or another person. What we want to do is counter that voice with something that's actually helpful, that comes from a healthier place. So practice speaking to yourself with compassion 100% of the time. What's going to happen is the client is going to find themselves going, oh my God, I can't believe you did that. You're so stupid, blah, 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 right? They'll go back to the pattern. And so the real key here is to interrupt that and go, oh, sorry, I forgot. We're actually speaking to ourselves with compassion. I'm sorry I said that. Here's what I would really like to say. Right? It's gonna, for some clients, that's gonna feel awkward and clunky, and they're gonna be like, ooh, I don't really talk to myself that way. That feels a bit blah. And it's like, it's okay, because you're resisting it, right? This is a way to resist it. And imagine if you actually start to build a more compassionate, kind relationship with yourself, right? Just notice what is coming up in that resistance. What is that protecting you from? Right. So giving a client an experiment to play with in between sessions where they're doing this, and getting them to notice what comes up, how do you resist it, when does this work as in you do speak to yourself with compassion for periods of time, what's that like, right? We're literally experimenting. This is not a kind of another version of perfectionism, where it's like, right, I'm doing this now and I better do it 100% of the time, right? It is literally an experiment. We are trying something new to see what happens. What happens could be a ton of resistance, which will give us more information to play with in the next coaching session. Yeah, makes sense. So the whole idea here is to give our clients experiments to play with. What might change for you if you started speaking to yourself with compassion? Right. Another great experiment for folks with a really loud critic is to be consciously imperfect. Right. Consciously imperfect. So I always say, you know, and a really good friend of mine who is classic perfectionist, she's type one Enneagram, the whole bit. And she at the moment is experimenting with art. Right, so she's painting portraits, and for the first like 3 months of this, she's like, oh my God, they're horrible. I could never show this to anyone. I'm so terrible at this. But she's like, oh, but I really found that I love these colors. This is kind of fun. I'm enjoying the process. I don't like the outcome. Right, being able to sit with that nuance is really helpful. So anything that involves play or creativity, something that you can't get right, is a great experiment for someone with a loud critic. Right? And get them to choose, right? Playing on purpose is huge, right? Playing a game of some sort. And what I will always look out for is someone with a real competitive nature, right? Are they playing or are they trying to win, right? So often, like getting on the floor with your kids, doing something that you are just doing for fun, right? That's the purpose here. We're playing on purpose, allowing yourself to be imperfect at something. There is no outcome that you have to reach, right? And practicing some boundaries around overwork, right? So for clients that I work with who are particularly in the corporate world, where they are deeply rewarded for having a loud inner critic that likes them to overwork. One of the boundaries that is a great place to start is, what time do you turn your work phone off at night? And for many clients, particularly those with a loud critic, they'll say, well, it's just on, because what if someone needs me? So just getting to a place of like, well, what's a reasonable time do you think to not be available for work? It might start off at 10 o'clock at night, right? For some folks, for some company cultures, that feels edgy. For others, it will be 6 p.m. For others, it will be earlier. But what we're doing is saying, you know, it's okay for you to practice that boundary. Most of the time, the resistance will come from something to do with the relationship, right? If I'm not perfect, overworking, overstriving, I'm going to lose something, right? And so it just gives us a ton of information to play with. But for people with a loud critic, the risk of burnout is often really strong. And so getting them to play with and experiment with boundaries around that tendency to overwork is a great place to start to just see what will happen, right? Maybe you'll get a ton of feedback that says, actually, it's safe for me to turn my phone off when I leave the building or when I log off my last Zoom call for the day. But if a person has a critic, they'll have a belief, it's not safe for me to do that. So what we're trying to do is build evidence of what actually is safe. Anyone got any questions around those experiments? Those kinds of like, oh, okay, that could be a way to get a client to work with this. Does that all feel kind of doable? Give me a wave if you want to ask a question or offer anything. All feel straightforward. Consciously imperfect. Yeah. So, let me just can we chat about this, Harriet? Are you available to actually? Yep. Here she is. Hello. Just having your dinner.
Sorry, having my dinner and the baby's being washed in the loo down here.
No
Yeah,
worries.
no, yeah. I just was trying to think of an example and I couldn't come up with one, so.
Yeah. Well, where would this show up for your clients or for you? Where's the perfectionism?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting because I was listening and I had like on the archetypes and definitely just know that I have a strong critic kind of protector. And I was thinking about, I don't know, things like social media posts or yeah, like kind of putting content out into the world, I guess. But I'm not with, I was trying to think of more of like a personal life like example. And I
Yeah.
wasn't quite coming up with one there.
Well, okay, so don't stress too much about the experiment, but tell me, where do you hear your critic the loudest?
When I feel like I've made a mistake.
So being consciously imperfect is allowing yourself to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Right, it's about not trying to control all of the factors.
Yeah, I think even in the experiment, I was trying to control it of like I should consciously like control the way that I am imperfect. But yeah, I see.
Nice. Yeah.
Could just
Yeah.
respond to mistakes. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a really great insight to have, right, about yourself is, oh, actually, even in the experiment, I want to control all the outcomes, right? And to experiment is really to play, right? It's really to go, I'm going to try something new and see what happens. Right? So, you could even do a little, one of the first ways, if I was coaching you, one of the first things I would say is just over the next week, just really notice where do you really, are you consciously aware of your critic? Where is it showing up? And just get a sense of that. Like, what are the conditions that it thrives in, right? And that will give us some great kind of information about, well, where can I just go, oh, this is good enough. This is okay. And meanwhile, we'd probably be exploring things like, what are the beliefs that are underneath that sense of needing to have control? Right, what's this being fueled by? Yeah. And that's why we usually look at the beliefs first, so that when the behavior ch starts to change, i.e. we start experimenting, there's a sense of, oh, I'm practicing the belief here that actually it's safe for me to make mistakes. I'm allowed to be an imperfect human, right? So it could be, and I mean, I'm just thinking of a really simple one that I've offered to a client before who shared a similar kind of situation. And she just practiced saying, oh, how human of me, every time she screwed up. How human of me, right? And it just became this kind of way that she would talk to herself with compassion, right? So you may want to even, come up with some ideas for how would you like to be talking to yourself when you make a mistake? Right? Because then it makes the conscious imperfection is really about allowing that to happen. That's going to feel safer when you know you've got you, even if you make a mistake. And, you know, it may be something, I know you're a parent, Harriet, so it may be something you think, well, how would I like to talk to my child if they make a mistake? How can I redirect that to me? Right. And so you end up kind of having this intuitive idea about what conscious imperfection looks like for you. And I would say for someone who has a really, you know, sort of aversion to making mistakes, if that's where your critic shows up, whatever you can do to support yourself to make it safe to make mistakes is really going to help.
Thanks, Seth.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Alan, there's always time for you.
Thank you. So I work with artists and creatives, and it often seems to me like the creative industries are built on overwork. Like, and it kind of seems like, especially with people with live performance and the making of that, that it's often loads of people who have really raging critics making that. And it seems like the whole culture of that industry in a way is built on that.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering, in terms of encouraging a client to put in boundaries around overwork, if they are working in that kind of culture, how do you do it?
Yeah. Well, it's the same. I mean, I totally hear you on the creative industry. I see this a lot with like corporate leaders as well, where the industry is basically built on a whole lot of unhealed people, almost in a sort of unconscious competition to outwork each other, right? And yeah, it's the same thing, right? Because the wider culture is saying, this is what we've got to do, right? So it takes some real courage to try some boundaries. And what I would say is go with the least risk options, right? So it could be that that a client starts off with, how can they create kind of almost like micro breaks, micro pauses where they come back to themselves within that culture? You know, is there a way that they can take a 10-minute break and go outside and actually feel the sun on their face or the rain on their face for a few minutes to create that sense of, oh, this is me. I'm choosing to be here, right? I'm choosing to be here. Remember why this matters to me, you know? And there's also like, you know, I've seen some folks get courageous about discussing this with other people. Who else here would love a 10-minute break right now? You know? So I think starting with the least risk options and seeing what happens. For some clients, it's like the level of risk is going to be very subjective. So for some clients, looking at their boundaries and what really matters to them, like what would make a difference to them. The first thing is to really offer that to yourself, like what matters to me? What is it that I would like? And, you know, experimenting with how you can create that for yourself before you communicate that or request it from other people is often a way of sort of building a bit of resilience around a boundary. And I also think like it's always good information that you're gathering, right? Oh, this is great information for this particular like performance, either studio or this theater or wherever I'm in, their culture doesn't really gel, or this director, this choreographer, whatever it is, that doesn't really gel with me. Oh, that's good information. So I can be here as an experiment, and it's good information for the choices I'll make in the future.
Okay.
What I would say is notice as well where you may want to rescue your client. And this is for all of us, right? When we see our clients in these cultures that are pretty brutal for lots of different reasons, I think one of the, you know, ongoing challenges of this work is that we can't impact the wider culture. We can only impact the person in the room. they can then go on to impact the wider culture. But I think there is often, for those of us who are kind of in this work to help people, and we can see actually clients amazing, this isn't anything to do with them, it's about the wider culture that they're in. The tendency is to want to solve all the problems. And what we want to actually do is give them, you know, some small doable steps that they can take to just get into the rhythm of interrupting these patterns, seeing what choices they do have. Does that help, Alan?
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Also, you know, a question I'm always asking is what would make a difference to you? What do you think feels doable? And sometimes with a critic, protector, I'll be like, and what's a step down from that, right? Because they will want to prove themselves in doing the experiment, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay. It's, you know, the body check stuff. How does it actually feel when you imagine doing it? How does that feel in your body? You know, coming back to that.
Okay, yeah, great.
If there's no resistance, that's a good sign that you're onto something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. Really cool. Great questions, guys. So the thing to really take away is the critic can't do enough to feel safe. That's not where the safety is going to come from. It's about creating a sense of self-acceptance. That's where the safety really comes from. Right, being in that space of compassion, imperfection, what are my needs, what are my emotions, what is true for me, and playing with that. Yeah. Okay, so the martyr, remember, is all about being needed. That's where it feels like safety comes from. If I'm needed, I'm okay, right? And that's driven by this belief that I don't matter as much as other people, as you, and so they're overgiving all the time. Right, to manage that fear of being abandoned or disliked or creating conflict in some way. Yeah. And so the martyr can't give enough to feel safe. That's not where safety comes from, right? That's not where safety comes from. So it's really about acknowledging emotions and prioritizing needs, right? So we're moving into that self-worth, that healthy adult self resource of self-worth. What do I need? What am I feeling right now, and what do I need? How do I create a boundary around that? How do I advocate for myself to have that taken care of, right? So, you know, again, I will always offer to a client, you know, getting a sense of where this shows up. Where are you dismissing your emotions or sacrificing your needs, and what is that protecting you from? To see where it shows up, it'll be different for every client. Yeah. And one of the things that I find fascinating is when you say to people, well, what would it mean to have some regular time and space just for you? Maybe it's just 10 minutes in the morning, right? Where you put a boundary around some space, right? Because the self-worth resource, that aspect of our healthy adult self, is all about advocacy and action, right? What do I need? How do I get it? It's about the space we take up and the territory we create for ourselves. So an experiment where you just claim regular time and space for you sounds innocent enough, right? Until it's like, oh, if I'm going to have half an hour to myself before I do anything else in the day, right? If I'm going to have a half hour kind of space for me in the morning, what I'll need to do to make that happen on a regular basis, right, a few times a week, means I'm going to have to negotiate with myself about what time I go to bed so I can get up in time. I'm going to have to probably negotiate with the people around me about what responsibilities I won't be taking on for that half hour. And maybe I can do the same for my partner if I'm sharing childcare or animal care, right? It's going to involve, subtly negotiating for your own needs and emotions that actually is counter to what the martyr is all about, which is I'm not as important as you, right? So it's all about just creating that space and time. And I can't tell you how many clients are like, oh, this revealed so many things about what I believe I'm allowed. What it's okay for me to have. So for those of you who work with folks who have this pattern, this martyr pattern, where I don't get any time for myself, it's everybody else's needs and mine are last, this can be a fantastic experiment to play with. Right? You just imagine what will come up. And again, this isn't about the positive outcome is you get more information, right? We're seeing what will happen. It's not about experimenting so that you can create this time and space, right? We actually, it's great if things go wrong or if you get unexpected results, because that's going to give you more information about what's going on, Reassuring our clients about that is often quite tricky, right? Limit the time spending doing things you hate. I can't even tell you how many clients will resist this one. If you're in this pattern of deprioritizing what you want to do in order to take care of other people, then you'll do a lot of things. You see this in domestic situations where it's like who in the house takes on the majority of the emotional labor. But you'll also see it in workplaces, right? Who's the one who, wants to take care of everybody else, remembers the birthdays and organizes the card around the office and all of that jazz? Who's taking on more than their normal share? What are they doing that they actually don't enjoy? Right? Because often the drive is to try and stay safe. It's not because you enjoy it. Right? So noticing, getting your clients to really notice, where is this coming up for you? What do you not like doing that you just think, oh, I only do that because, I'll be judged by other people, right? It'll create conflict. And inviting them to limit the time they spend doing it or just bin it off altogether. It's quite an interesting experiment to play with. Anyone thinking, oh, I know some clients that would really benefit from doing that? Yeah. And the other thing is to really practice honesty with themselves, right? So getting a client to actually start paying attention to what they need. A great way to do this is to just set an alarm like 3 times a day on your phone, a little reminder. What do you need right now? And just get a sense of it. Do you need a break? Do you need a hug? Do you need to finish the task you're doing? Do you need to give yourself a bit of a high five in whatever way is meaningful? Like, what do you need right now? Do you need company? Do you need a walk outside? Do you need to play on the floor? Right, you're in the practice of acknowledging what you need, right? Which for that martyr pattern is like, oh, I've got to ignore my needs and give to other people to feel safe, right? So we're just interrupting that pattern. And another one which is really about kind of bringing in some boundaries. What is one thing you could do differently in one relationship? So quite often clients will be with this martyr pattern will be very sensitive to particular relationships. They'll feel like it's risky, or there is if I don't behave a certain way, I won't have this relationship, this friendship, this connection. And so, it can be about experimenting with that. If you're the person who's constantly checking WhatsApp to see what the mum's group is saying, or if you're constantly checking Instagram after you post something because you're, desperate to see that it's been, you're quite attached to how it's received. It's like, what's one thing you could do differently with that relationship? Maybe it's something like I'm going to practice posting to Instagram and then deleting the app off my phone for 2 hours and just seeing what happens, right? just seeing what happens. What is the process? How does that feel to you? Right. I'm going to turn off notifications. I'm going to practice interacting on that parents' WhatsApp group for, at a specific time of the day that actually suits me when I feel okay. Yeah. I'm managing a team at work, so I'm going to recognize my energy is highest in the mornings. So I'm going to have my one-to-one sessions with my team in the mornings. I'm going to reschedule those to suit me, to suit my needs. Right. And I'm going to make sure that I've got enough time to prepare for those. And so the client starts to, through these experiments, they're slowly interrupting this pattern. It's okay for you to have self-worth, right? That's where your safety is going to really come from, is no matter how it's received by other people, you're okay. Anyone got any questions about experimenting with that pattern? Kat?
Hi.
Hey, love. Hey.
I have a well, it's kind of a question, kind of a reflection. I see a lot of the martyr probably coming up in mothers, people who are in the early years of motherhood. And I wonder if you're coaching someone where ultimately it's a relationship with their child. There's often a lot, there's not as much movement, I guess, in something. So for example, a mum may, I don't know, hate doing bath time, for example, and but like still got to do it. Or the child may only want the mum to do bath time or bedtime. Or they may be breastfeeding, or there are things that kind of play into that. Would you, my reflection is, would you then encourage them to look at other relationships and how they could do more in other spaces where if there's not scope for movement with that particular relationship, and they probably wouldn't want to, even though they, giving a lot, they wouldn't want to necessarily change that. But yeah, is that what you would do then? Explore
Yeah.
other relationships where.
So there's a couple of ways to approach this, right? And yeah, we're not
Not saying I don't
advocating
do part
for
time.
mums to just abandon the child, right? Like, of course, yeah. And actually, there is this, we are interdependent, right, on each other. We do need healthy relationships with other people. My sense is that the healthiest connections come from when we belong to ourselves, right? That when we're full up, then it's easier to have those connections. So there's a couple of ways to approach this when it's about parenting. The first is, what are your beliefs around, like, let's just take the example of bath time. Hate bath time. It's a nightmare. It's a mess. I've got my over-functioning self that doesn't love the process. And I'm exhausted at the end of the day and I really don't want to do it, right? So there's some things you could do with that, right? You can play with your beliefs around bath time, right? What do I believe? Can I get to a place where I'm okay with it? I sort of feel a bit neutral about it. Bath time is necessary. What are the benefits of it? And can you negotiate that with a partner if it's not, if that's possible? Can your child, may have a preference for you, but is it possible that they could develop an okayness with your partner, right? Because there's often that belief, only I can do it, which is a great one to interrupt, right? So that there's that, right? How can I share this so it's not as tricky? And the other thing is, how can you sort of get, just kind of accept, I don't love bath time, right? That's actually I'm just going to accept that about myself. Don't love bath time, not my favorite, quite bored by it. Seems to be a bit of a nightmare. I get kind of, for whatever reason, don't love it. Can I accept that? And can I take care of myself afterwards so that I'm okay, right? So my need for some peace and quiet afterwards or something like that is met, right? Maybe that's okay. So bedtime is something that's handled by someone else, or after my child is in bed, I get to do this other thing. Right. So it's about kind of the before, during, and after is the ways to look at this. What are the beliefs about this thing? And can you get to a place where you feel pretty neutral about it? Can you accept that you just don't love it and you don't have to make yourself wrong, right, about that? Can you take care of yourself afterwards? Or can you ask to, can you negotiate that with someone else, other people? And it's about kind of like playing with the possibilities, right? Because what will happen when someone has this mata pattern is there's only one way to do this, and it's got to be on me. And so what we're introducing is some choices and some possibilities. Maybe that's not true. What else could be true? How does that sound to you?
Yeah, it does. Sorry, there's a plane coming over, which yeah, it makes sense, definitely. And that's kind of what I was thinking. I was kind of thinking in, and I guess going back to what you were saying before, like the least risky experiment. So in that situation, let's say there was a mum who, felt she had to always do bedtime and their child had a very strong preference, so it made it quite difficult not doing it. You could even look at things like, okay, well, if you do every every 10 bedtimes, and then your husband does the 10th or ninth, they do the 10th or something. Or I guess what is the kind of the gap, the little bit of movement for them that they could look at and be comfortable with? Yeah, makes sense.
Exactly. And often people will say, intellectually, I know my partner could do this as well. There's something in me that resists doing that. What if the child ends up preferring the partner? Then where am I? I'm not needed as much anymore. That feels unsafe to me. Right? So there'll be it, so it's worth exploring where is this need to be needed coming from, right? So the experiments I think need to be in partnership with looking at the underlying beliefs, right? We're looking for the least resistance approach to interrupting a pattern, interrupting a belief, which we're taking, the idea of mindset work is great, but we're actually taking this into a more grounded place where you get to see how does this change in reality? Well, I've got to do something different to see that, to really test the legitimacy of this belief. No one else can do this except me. Really cool. Great question. And, Kate, I think that is honestly, I think the one of the trickiest aspects of any of these patterns is when it shows up in your primary relationships, when you have, highly dependent folks. It's always going to stir all this stuff up. And you can still make some real difference and progress, right? Where you're actually like giving the client way more choices than they have to play with. Really cool. Really cool. Okay. Let's talk about the scapegoat. Everyone's favorite. The aim here is to not try or quit, right? It's like it's too hard. If I don't try, then I'll be safe. And it's all because of this belief, like this is so much harder for me, like I can't do this. Right. And so we feel overwhelmed. And this is usually about trying to manage the fear of responsibility, of consistency, of keeping promises, right? It's the kind of adulting protective pattern. But the truth is, of course, that you can't quit enough for the scapegoat to feel safe. That's not where safety comes from. There's a difference between, quitting because you love the reason that you're not trying, right? It's like, oh, that's just out of preference for me. Don't even want it. Versus, I can't do this because I just can't. It's so much harder for me. And so we want to experiment with, keeping promises, taking responsibility, moving into that self-trust, kind of resource around, making decisions and trusting ourselves to be with whatever the outcome is. So there's some really great, a really great way to start this is to look at where is the client feeling overwhelmed, right? What's coming up for them around overwhelm and what is that protecting them from? And again, sometimes you're going to see I think not as often perhaps, but you're still going to see places where a client is feeling overwhelmed because of the external circumstances, right? But what I've found with this, because it's perhaps an under-functioning protector, is the overwhelm is often self-created, right? Or it is, you can sense into it that actually the client has quite a lot of choices here. Practice keeping a promise to yourself for 30 days. Could be anything, anything at all. One low risk promise to yourself. Right, I'm going to walk to the public transport hub rather than drive or do something that, if it doesn't feel great, feels like it's too complicated, I'm going to simplify something. Right, I'm going to get to work 20 minutes earlier so I can create some space for myself. Now, what would it mean to interrupt that sense of overwhelm? How could you play with keeping a promise to yourself? Yeah. Organize or complete one thing today, right? Start with the drawer of doom, right? If there's a drawer in your kitchen that just feels completely like it's full of crap, just organize that. Like, prove to yourself that you can actually complete something. That's really low risk and simple. Yeah. A client I worked with who was a very successful lawyer, during lockdown, sort of we had a session where she explained to me that she wasn't coping with living on her own and managing her own home. And she hadn't opened her mail in like 2 months. And she had a huge amount of shame around it. Like, she's like, this does not make sense. I am trying to, you know, cope in this situation, but I'm resilient and professional and sorted. And why is it that I can't even open my mail? Right. And so as we explored some of the beliefs, it was very much around this sense of feeling completely overwhelmed by what was going on and the fact that it was sort of all on her. You know, she didn't have, you know, her usual kind of support people in place. And so just getting that sense of, oh, okay, I can open 5 bits of mail today. I can open 5 bits tomorrow, right? It started her on that process of feeling less overwhelmed. Yeah. Great question, Alan. If someone has both a critic and the scapegoat working together, would that person most likely suggest a promise that was actually a highly idealized, perfect version of themselves so they can be very hard to keep? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So when you've got two protectors working together, the idea is to choose one context and move around the healthy adult self compass to sort of spot where's the best intervention, right? Because what will probably happen is if they have a critic and a scapegoat, you may be able to tease out what is the loudest one in this particular context and what would help to interrupt that pattern the most, right? If it's the critic, then it's about compassion, right, and imperfection. And if it's the scapegoat, then it's much more about trusting themselves. So it's about kind of getting under the skin of what's actually present here, you know, what's at risk. Great question. Does that kind of help, Ellen? Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, you probably do this many, many times over the course of a coaching relationship. So it's not like it's a once and done thing, right? We're always wanting to be experimenting with interrupting these unhealthy patterns. And the other aspect of this is, where does your overwhelm make complete sense and who can help? And I can't tell you how many, particularly women in midlife, who have found out that actually they are neurodiverse through answering this question. That their overwhelm was actually about this is just how I see things. I can't concentrate for this amount of time, or I find it really tricky to take something from start to completion, right? And so who can help? Oh, maybe I am neurodiverse. Maybe I'll go check that out, right? And so all to say, like, none of these protective patterns are wrong, right? It's about giving our clients way more choices to see where safety really comes from, right? Because getting into that state where they're just quitting because that feels like the safest thing actually isn't that healthy or fulfilling for them. And so we want to give them more options. Equally, someone who is on the edge of burnout, overwhelm, that feeling of overwhelm makes complete sense. I just can't do it today. And I'm having more and more days like that, where small things are sending me into a panic, into a sense of overwhelm. It's a really great sign of burnout. It's a really good thing to pay attention to. We're asking more questions. We're trying to figure out what's actually going on for our client, entering into their world so we can see how can we help them to interrupt these patterns. Yeah. And as you start to play with this, you just get better at seeing, oh, okay, intuitively I know, I can hear that martyr pattern, so I'm going to move to self-worth. What can I help you advocate for yourself around? What can I help you to put a boundary around, to take action for, advocate for yourself? Yeah. So you get really good at spotting this as you move through it, particularly when we get to module 9, and you'll start to see how these things fit together. And the last one is the bystander, right? Which is very much about just wait, right? Because you don't have enough information. Sorry, Alan, let's just pause for a second. I want to address this. Sorry, everyone. I just want to make sure I'm addressing your questions as they come up. Alan, can you just say more about your question?
So it was just because what you said, you know, overwhelm and getting overwhelmed by little things is a really key sign of burnout. And obviously, I know you said earlier that the critic is the one that's often most perhaps prone to burnout. So if you spotted somebody, you know, you're talking about overwhelm, and you spotted that as like, oh, it makes sense, like it seems like there's burnout, you would then move to helping them work with the critic, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. If you can see that link, right? It's like, and it's more about, you know, I mean, don't get too kind of lost in the detail of getting this right, right? It's like, what does your client need right now? That's what we're trying to do. That's what we're trying to understand, is what's the pattern? What would best support them, right? What we actually want to do is have a client where all four of these resources are elevated, right? Where they feel resourced to respond to their situations no matter what, right? So, yeah, if you see that the overwhelm is linked to burnout, then, yeah, absolutely, that's a sign of overwork, right? And that is a connection between that. It's a kind of consequence of too much overwork. So it's the scapegoat is really almost hiding a overexpressed critic, right? Overwork, overwork, overwork until you burn out. But getting to the place of, oh, okay, I'm realizing that this client is burned out or close to it, then moving to compassion and perfection, right? Taking care of self-acceptance. I'm accepting that I just can't do this at this pace. I need something to change, right? And so, you know, for anyone, any client who's burnt out, then we don't want to give them more to do, right? We want to give them something to feel. We want to give them permission to feel and to really tune into what they need. Yeah. But yeah, don't get too kind of caught, and it's absolutely natural that you would be like, oh, but in this circumstance, what would I do here? Just notice, what are the themes that you see in your clients? Where are your clients? What's the pattern you're most familiar with your clients? And kind of start there. Get good at spotting, oh, here's some places you can interrupt it. You can play with it, right? Does that help you, Alan? Yeah? Cool. Great. Great question. So with the bystander, right, the safety comes from waiting, right? That sense of if I just wait until I know more, then I'll know what to do, right? So they get stuck in overthinking. And it's all about managing the fear of making the wrong choice, failing, looking foolish, all of that. Makes total sense, right? It's a really good strategy. But the thing is, you can't wait long enough for that bystander to feel safe, right? You can't know enough for the bystander to feel safe. That's not where safety comes from. It comes from self-trust, right? And so we're moving around the compass to that to self-belief, right? That is the resource, the healthy self-resource that's most going to support the bystander. And that's about your self-belief is about your self-leadership, right? About values. It's about, envisioning something for your life and encouraging yourself to take steps towards it, right? So we want to encourage someone with a bystander pattern to make decisions, take values-led action, right? So the experiments look like, just getting a sense of where are they waiting and what's that protecting them from, right? Really auditing that. Paying attention to their future fantasies, idealized worlds, right? If this happens, then I'll be fine. Then everything will be great, right? So what's one thing you can actually do to bridge that gap? Yeah, what's one action you can take that will actually support you to move towards the future ideal life that you're imagining? Playing with shared accountability, right? So finding someone else who shares your values and, taking steps together, supporting each other together, can be amazing for someone with a really strong bystander. And connecting to that bigger picture, your values, your why, recognizing I'm choosing to do this. What is it that gets expressed if I do this? This can be particularly helpful for business owners who get really stuck in that bystander place. Yeah. What is this really about? What's the experiment you can take to allow one of your values to be expressed? Yeah. And the other thing is to find ways to be embodied and in the moment. Really help with a bystander who's kind of stuck, What can you do outside of the thing that's holding you back from that just allow you to be in the moment, allow you to feel a bit more in your body? Because that's the thing, right? It's the whirring, overthinking brain that gets people stuck. So anything that you can come into your body is great. It's really going to help. Anyone know that they kind of work with they work with people who have that bystander pattern? Yeah. How does that feel in terms of a way of interrupting that or beginning to experiment with that? Yeah. Anyone want to share? You
I can
okay?
share. So when I am coaching mums, often it's about their return to work and people saying, I don't know what, like people have had longer career breaks after having children and then they don't know what to go back to. And then there is a bit of that bystander behavior of like, I just need to look into it more, or if I research this, or if my children then start school, then that'd be a better time. And like that kind of pattern. And I think actually it's interesting because like my conscious thing that I would usually go to would be exploring values with someone and sort of purpose. What would drive you and what would that look like and how could you follow that, because they can get stuck in a bit of like, oh, I just don't know because I've been out for so long or I'm just not connected enough to kind of definitely look into it. That's probably where I would see it show up the most, I think.
Yeah, completely. And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like getting into a place of, well, you can just stay in this place of prevaricating over decision making, but what would get expressed in you? What would you get to experience if you did make a decision? Right? What's the best case outcome here? And you get insight into what really matters to a person. Right? And I think often for folks who get stuck in overthinking, it's really about not making the wrong decision. Whereas where we want to support them to get to is a place where you can make a decision and whatever the outcome, with the best information that you have and whatever the outcome is, You can take care of yourself. You can kind of live with that. Yeah, great example, Kat. Anyone else? Any questions on those, you know, that just that experimentation idea? Does that all feel kind of safe? Clear, rather. The thing to notice is, and I think, you know, Ellen, you've picked up on this, is, you know, what we want to do is have these different approaches depending on the pattern, because what we don't want to do is reinforce the pattern. We want to interrupt it, right? So giving someone who is in that overworking, overgiving pattern, we don't want to give them more to do, right? We want to give them space to actually feel. Whereas for folks who are in that feeling overwhelmed or overthinking, we want to help them to take action that is a really helpful, you know, to support them. Yeah. Yeah, Holly. You need to unmute, love. Sorry.
Something that keeps coming up over the last few modules, I know we've touched on when someone has quite a complex self-doubt. Would you say there is a lot? Let me start again.
A sophisticated protector.
There we go.
Yeah.
And that keeps coming in the back of my mind because I've got that. I can identify myself in so many of this, so many of these things. And when you're coaching with someone, do you find that you kind of go through this process with one aspect of them and you kind of go back, but that sounds very nice and neat? Do you find that you have all sorts of things that are coming up and then you kind of just deal with whatever's most important at that time and you dig in and go back and work on different things? Or how does it work when there's a lot of different self-doubt things going on?
So for folks with this really sophisticated protector where they can, you can hear it and they probably identify with all of the patterns at various times. So I think we all have all of them, and they just, you know, different contexts will, you know, activate these patterns at different times and at different intensities, right? So what I would say when you're working with someone who has quite loud protectors, and there's more than one that you can hear, is to not be afraid to just slow down, right? Even if they are kind of like, I just need to get all of this out or whatever, it's like their approach, often their approach will be, I'm going to give you all this information, I need you to sort it out. And I think as practitioners, we just need to be really cognizant of that. It will absolutely activate that rescuer tendency in us when we've got a client who's got a lot going on. So a couple of things that I would say is, firstly, you want to find out what's the priority for the client. So if they're giving you a lot of information or a lot of context, and you can hear different protectors, it's like, you know, what feels the most important thing to look at today? And let them choose. You know, don't make assumptions about what actually matters. So let them choose what the priority is and kind of slow down to really take them through that process of understanding what is going on. And then you're just using your own discernment. Do we need to look at what's the belief that's underneath this first? Are they ready to maybe experiment with trying something new? What feels the most useful approach here, right? So you can trust yourself with this. And I think the thing to always reassure a client who's got a lot of stuff is the beauty of this work is that it has a domino effect. It doesn't really matter where we go with this. The idea here is that you are learning how to feel resourced, how to really be okay with who you are and how you're responding to your life, right? That's what we're doing here. So if we only spend time really, you know, addressing self-worth stuff over a 6-month coaching contract, if that's the thing. If that's the priority for the client, then you might never really talk about anything else. You might just be looking at the beliefs and the behaviors and the patterns around that one thing. Equally, you might find that actually there is a couple of patterns that are really dominant. And just mirroring that back to the client, you know, it's this what the way I'm learning that you work is that you've got what we'd call a really strong martyr pattern. That doesn't mean you are a martyr. It means that that's the way you've learned to keep yourself safe. And it's, you know, we sort of share a bit more about that. So they kind of know what they're dealing with. The reason that we kind of explain the model to people is so that they can spot that part of themselves. Yeah. So just to sort of sum up what I've offered there, Holly, because it was a lot, is when you've got a client who's got a sophisticated protector, is bringing a lot of things, and you're hearing patterns from different protective kind of areas, don't be afraid to slow down and get the client to direct you in terms of the priority for this particular session. Get a sense of, you know, do they need to work on their beliefs around this thing? Or do they want to move into action? That could just be a preference for them, right? And you can even ask them, does it feel important to really look at what you're thinking about this? Or would it be more helpful to look at, you know, what you're doing? You know, like really kind of use that consent button as much as you can. Because you're doing more than one thing there, right? You're inviting them to participate. They're making choices. They're sharing what's going on for them. And even mirroring that back to them, you know, so that they can sort of feel like, oh, even in the coaching session, I'm demonstrating that I've got discernment. I can choose this stuff. Yeah. So I don't know if how does that kind of land for you, Holly, just in terms of like slowing down, let the client set the agenda, use your own discernment around what feels important.
Yeah, I think that makes me feel comfortable with it. More comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. This coaching stuff, it really is a two-way relationship. You know, the most useful thing we can do is stop helping so much, right? It's like invite the client to participate. You know? Yeah. Really great question, Holly. Thank you. I know that's probably helpful for everybody. Yeah. Cool. So are you kind of seeing the link here that we can't change the pattern with the same energy that created it? We've got to move people into trying new things, right? You can't overwork your way around a critic. So what I'd love to do is to show you how I would coach with that, right? Just to give you a sense of playing with these two parts, right? The protector pattern and the healthy adult self, right? So I just wonder if you could choose, just for yourself, just choose an area of dissatisfaction in your life and write it down for yourself. Something that's like not working for you right now, something in your coaching work, in your business, in your personal life. Like, where is self-doubt emerging for you right now? Could be a specific thing, general area. Just name something for yourself. Really doesn't matter what it is. It's just for the purposes of demonstrating this to yourself. And I just want you to imagine that there is this protector part of you, right? This part of you that is trying to keep you safe. It's trying to hold you back. It's doing its best. Really doesn't want you to be hurt again. And so When you think about this area of your life that self-doubt showing up in, okay, just want you to ask that protector part, what are you worried about right now? What is your protector worried about right now? Just ask it and see what comes up. Highly recommend doing this on the page because you're actually accessing your internal workings. What is your protector worried about when it comes to this thing? And, you know, let everything be welcome. It doesn't matter how irrational it feels or how much you wish this wasn't true. Just let yourself be honest. When you've got a few notes there, just thank your protector for being with you. Thank it for sharing whatever it shared, just in your mind. It's helpful to know this, right? You're making the unconscious conscious. And then just read back what you've written. Might want to move your body a little bit to shake that off. So okay, that's one thing that feels true right now, right? And so we want to get into like what else is true. So I want you to imagine that you also have inside you a healthy adult self. Right? It's part of you that's really resourced. It's healthy. It's got access to self-belief and self-worth, self-trust, self-acceptance, no matter how well expressed those resources feel in you. There's part of you that is kind of taking care of the protector. And so just read your dilemma from the perspective of your healthy adult self. What does your healthy adult self make of this? What does it want you to know? What does your healthy adult self want you to know about this situation? Notice the difference between the two if you read through it. Is there are you kind of surprised by what each of those parts came up with? Like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Yeah. So what we're going to do is just get into pairs, and I want you to do two things with each other. Like share your, you know, just the sort of top line of your dilemma, but explain to your partner what the protective pattern is that you're hearing in yourself, right? Like, can you name it? What feels present right now? And also, what is your healthy self offering you as a potential experiment? something to play with. Could be about a new belief, right? So we're trying to take that information from the protector, from the healthy adult self. What's the pattern and what's a possible experiment you could play with this real life thing, right? So we're going to coach each other. Just take kind of 5 minutes each just to sort of, you know, play with this as an idea. Yeah. See where you get to. All right. I'm just going to pause. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. How was that? Anyone want to share anything that came up? Was it easy to clarify the pattern? Easy to kind of get a sense of what to experiment with?
I should share something actually.
Yeah, Joe.
I mean, I had, because this happened yesterday, so I did have like a story and the healthy adult self. I could see the interplay and all that, but I think the pattern I couldn't get to, or I wasn't sure of.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the pattern?
Do you want to share a little bit about what it was?
Yeah, I can do it.
The situation was.
Basically, it's about like a kind of promotion opportunity at work. I was saying to Ruth, so, you know, had a discussion with the manager about 12 months ago about this being potentially coming in 6 months. And then at the end of last year, kind of had the same conversation and was like, okay, it's coming another 6 months. And that's now we're now mid-year. And I kind of had a conversation yesterday and was like, okay, he was very kind of hedging and, you know, it may or may not, and looking towards the end of the year again. And I kind of just spiraled because I felt like, I can't believe we're having the same conversation 12 months on. Yeah, and just
What's your self-doubt saying about it? What was the protective voice?
Just feeling like I'd done something wrong that I didn't know about.
Right.
And I definitely think it was like kind of bystander, like just kind of almost feeling foolish.
Right. Like yeah, yeah.
Having the same conversation like 3 times and feel like, yeah. What's the right way for me to even to respond to this now without, you know, just losing it?
Well, and I guess I wonder, is there a sense of overthinking?
Yeah.
Like I can overthink my way out of it. If I think enough, find my way around this.
Yeah, or work harder. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What feels so you've got a kind of critic bystandery combo-y type thing going on. That sounds like what was present. What was your healthy adult self's response?
So I kind of like was doing some self-coaching last night then thinking about it, and I was thinking about how like in the 6 months of this year, like 4 months were great. And then I took 2 weeks in May, was just exhausted, actually got engaged. So all of these things happened that I came back after this 2 weeks off. And like, the truth is I was distracted. I was kind of switched off. I've struggled really to get back into any flow of work. June, I kind of had like, you know, I've just come off antibiotics. I had like sinusitis for 3 weeks. So actually 2 months out of the six were not really great. So when I kind of stand back and look back at it, and also that like, I don't think I really necessarily want the progression or the role that I'd be promoted in. It was more just like the standard setting for myself. And like, you know, I've been on this path now for 3 years. So if it doesn't happen, it's a problem. But then it's like, you know, what would it be like to be just good enough for a year?
Yeah. 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 So I love how your healthy adult self is just like, well, let's kind of go helicopter view over all of this and see all the different things that are going on. And just getting into that place of, do I even actually want this? Like I'm feeling foolish about something, but do I even want this? Like that sounds like a very kind of healthy question to be asking yourself, right? So I mean, what are you feeling in terms of like something to experiment with?
I think what I struggle with in the call with the manager yesterday is that I think he knows this, and he was kind of saying like,
Right.
you're hesitating. He could read me, but I don't feel like I can say that to him, like, oh, I don't think I want this. I feel like I
Right.
have to present
Right.
like, okay, well, I'll just keep working hard or doing more or doing whatever you tell me to.
Yeah.
But I think he does know
Right.
that it's actually not true for me. And maybe
Yeah.
that's why
Yeah.
he's also hesitating.
Right. Right. So I'm curious to know, like, what would you like to do to take care of you in this situation?
Like, I think it's almost like maybe a clearing the air with him, like to get us on the same page where I felt like I was being honest, because I think that's great causing.
And do you know yet what page you're on?
Yeah. Well, like on the one hand, I'm not interested in particularly progressing in this career in this role.
Right.
And I think I said that to him a year ago, and so, yeah, it makes sense that he may be holding off on me. Yeah.
Right. So I guess one of the things I would sort of offer as a way to kind of create some safety for yourself in this is just to spend a couple of days playing with the idea that you don't want to progress it, right? Like kind of almost like acting as if I've decided this and seeing what comes up for you, just so you can kind of sit with that decision, so that when you communicate it, you've already played it through in your own mind. You've already kind of covered off the different bases. How does that sort of feel? It's just a way of playing with this.
Like, it was just take the pressure off of like feeling that I have to have this forward motion. Yeah.
Because even the forward motion of, right, let's have the conversation, let's clear the air, like there's that energy to this, isn't there? That might be driven from him, but may also be how you're responding. But it sounds like just taking a breath to go, okay, cool. Do I want this? Like really answering that for yourself and sitting with, okay, let's pretend I don't want this and see what comes up.
Feels good. Yeah.
And so notice that that's allowing you to play with your own discernment, which is all the self-trust resource. It's allowing you to play with, well, what am I, what is the kind of values that I'm holding in this decision, which is all about self-belief. So you really get to play with this in a way that, like you say, it just feels like the pressure's off a bit. You're in a place of choice now. You're a bit
Yeah.
more regulated with the situation. Yeah, really cool.
Thanks, Sus.
Yeah, you're super welcome. So folks, that's just kind of how I would coach a person, right? Is you're kind of playing with what's the situation, what's the pattern, and you're getting a sense of how they're responding to it so that you can offer them, well, what do you want to do here? Like, what options do you have? How can you play with this? What I would really encourage you to do in your practice pods is to take this away, get good at even when someone's bringing something and you're playing with a different approach or practicing a different tool, get clear for each other. What's the pattern here? What's the protective pattern? Get kind of good at naming that and then noticing, even if you just, park the workbook, ignore everything, coach the person, and then go back and go, oh, where did we go with this? What you'll probably find is you're intuitively moving around the compass, right? It's almost like it's a sort of logical approach that you'll be taking with it. And it's also that kind of revisiting the model is a great way of saying, oh, did we miss anything here? Right. Oh, don't forget to look at how are you feeling in this, right? Can you play with it? All of this sort of stuff. So it's a great way of just having that balance of trusting your own discernment as a practitioner. How would you naturally coach a person around this? And spotting the pattern and making sure you're okay, how can we take this even deeper and look at what experiments the person could play with? Experiments are really the secret sauce, I think, because they take new beliefs and make them real. Right? They take new beliefs. So all the stuff we worked on in module five is really around, uncovering new beliefs, new ways of looking at something. And with these protective patterns, we're looking at how can we experiment in a way that doesn't exacerbate the pattern, but interrupts it, from a new place. One last thing I would say is expect resistance, right? The client is going to probably resist it. So it's always like, what has the least amount of resistance, right? Joe's like, gung ho, right? I'm going to have my conversation with my manager. And actually it's like an invitation. Well, could you spend some time just playing with this yourself, this decision yourself, getting into a place where there's no resistance. And it takes out that tendency for the overwork, right? Of the critic that's present for Joe. Like we're just softening that. Just notice what you're feeling about it, what you're thinking about it. And for us as practitioners, I think we need to get really good at detaching from any outcome and encouraging our clients to do the same, right? The purpose of experimenting is to try something new to see what happens. What happens could be a shit ton of resistance, right? Which just means the experiment's probably too big. Or it could be that you get a ton more information about what's going on for the client. That's great. That helps us to know what's going on, right? So the outcome isn't that the experiment goes perfectly, right? That really isn't important. It's more about what comes up for the client. So just encouraging you to play with this, get familiar with the patterns, start to, see how you can help your clients to interrupt them, practice in your pods. Trust that you're going to get to know this as a way of taking experiments and challenging the legitimacy of these protective beliefs. You're going to get really comfortable with this and know it very well. Any final questions, comments, observations? Thanks, Joe.
I
All
don't know
good.
if everyone's gonna
Yeah,
hate me.
Holly.
I don't know if everyone's gonna hate me because it is 8:45, but this is a big one, and I
Okay.
think it might be interesting to everyone, I hope. So I'm wondering, how do you have you had the protector show up in your coaching sessions? Because I know for me, I've worked with therapists, with coaches who have said something or done something that's right, but it's rattled that protector. And in some way, shape, or form, and I've got angry, not like really angry, but I felt anger, or I've tried to shut it down, or I've wanted to end that coaching relationship or that therapeutic relationship, or it shows up, right? Because it's entrenched, it doesn't want to just be explored and, for a new pattern to come into play. So how do you deal with that? Because I can't imagine it's all just merrily going along, and this protector doesn't play out in sessions.
So you're asking a hypothetical question. So I'm going to come at you with a hypothetical response, right? But I've had very few instances where someone gets angry about a protector being activated. What I do have is clients saying, "Oh, this is activating my protector. I can feel it," right? And so what we want to do in those situations is create like the safety and trust with the client so that they feel safe enough to share what's going on for them. And to do that, you're checking in. How's that landing? What's going on for you? Everything's welcome, right? I would say if a client is kind of getting activated and angry about a protector, but that's really worth exploring. What's going on for you right now? Or if you spot it, you seem angry. Tell me about that. Am I picking that up right? Tell me more about what's going on for you. It's all useful information, right? But I think the process is about being with the client as they're in that, right? Is there a question that you, sorry, go ahead, Kat.
As a continuation of this idea. So
yep.
I've had it recently actually with a client where they have kind of, they haven't been angry, but they've shown some resistance in terms of like, I'm not sure what to do, or I don't know, or just, you know, you sometimes get that sense with someone that they're leaving feeling a bit, uncomfortable might be the word, or a bit sort of like, resistant, I guess.
Shutting down almost.
Shutting down a little bit, being like, whatever it might be. Yeah. Do you think, would you call that out in the moment, or would you let them sit with it and come back and say,
I would invite them to share about it. I'm sensing pulling away. I'm sensing something's happened between us. What's going on for you? Do you want to share? Yeah.
And I guess if you've contracted, because I think sometimes I reflect on it, have I contracted enough to go into it with them? Because if I don't feel like I have, then that can sometimes be, because if you have contracted, then I think you have more permission to be like, this is what we were talking about and how, what's coming up for you and et cetera. Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And also don't be afraid to recontract with people, right? You could, if they don't want to talk about it, you could leave it. And then at the start of the next session, just say, hey, I'm reflecting on the end of our last session. And I just wanted to offer space to chat about what happened if you wanted to share. You know, and you can reflect back, this was my experience of the situation. I felt you pull away, or I felt some frustration, or something was happening for you. And I'm curious about that, right? And you can also say, like, what do we want to do when big emotions come up? What feels easiest for you? What I do really also recommend is, if you find it as a practitioner really tricky to be with those emotions, but that's where supervision is paramount, right? If you've got clients that are coming to you and they've got emotions, and then you turn it and make it a thing about you, that's a thing that's really worth looking at, right? Yeah. Because then that will absolutely bleed into sessions, right?
Yeah. That's my, in that situation with that particular client, if I think back to my thoughts at the moment, I thought, oh my god, I fucked it up, like I've done something to, you know what I mean? And I can see that. So you're right.
And notice as well, like, you may also be picking up on what they're feeling. Oh my god, I fucked this up. I'm not doing this right. I'm not being the right client, or this feels icky, I don't like it. You know, I don't like how I'm feeling about this. I want to get away from this and think about it, or feel about it, or whatever. You may be picking up on that, on the client, but it's this endless invitation for them to share, so that whatever they put on the table, you can kind of bless the mess and see what's there and figure out a way forward, right? Yeah. I don't know if that helps you, Holly, or if there is a like specific client or someone you're thinking of around this?
No, I think it's really helpful, because what I realized is, I think perhaps I was blindsided, and that was the bad thing. But I think in this kind of work, as Kat said, with the contracting, and also I think there's a lead up to these conversations. And I remember I started having resistance in one of our demos. I started panicking, and you were like, you're safe, you see something really beautiful. You're safe, it's okay, whatever. It was so nice. And that immediately took the resistance away, and then I could access that. I can see now what needs to happen. That container needs to be set up.
Yeah.
I think as well, like, just really, like, taking it slow. You know, so you're less likely to blindside a client if you're taking it slow and just seeing what's here and being with that, taking time to respond. I think it's also sometimes I found, if you do offer like voice note type support in between sessions, if that kind of thing happens, what I'll usually do is send a client a voice note the day after, just saying, hey, I'm thinking about our session. My sense was something happened there at this point in the session. Did you feel that too? Should we talk about it? You know, it's almost like, let's kind of put it on the table. And the client may not respond, or they might, you know, it depends on who they are and how long the relationship is and all kinds of stuff. But if you can kind of offer that with some loving detachment, then what you find is your client is more likely to feel safe that, oh, it's okay to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. One of the things we'll talk about in module 8 is the utter shit show that is how we deal with conflict in our culture, right? And so we'll talk more about that. Yeah.
Thank you, Sass. That was really helpful.
Great question. Thanks. Thanks, Holly.
Great question. Yeah. Thanks for your contributions too, Kat. Thanks, Holly. Cool.
Okay.
All right, my loves. Take care of yourselves. I know this was a bit of a long one, but I'm hoping that it's helped to just kind of pull this model together a bit for you. And we'll be diving into this more about how this impacts us in the next module. So really cool. All right. I'll see you soon. Take care, everyone.
Bye, Kat. Bye, Sam.
Bye.